We don't be getting mad, we too busy getting even. We too busy getting even. If you always talking, well now it's your time to listen. Whatever you thought this city was called, it's on occupied land we're living. Just cause you was born here, don't make you a native. The indigenous of this land, we're purposely created to protect the earth, the ones who work here first. Get the last word, poppers, I'm concerned. Watch what they saying, claiming what they claim it. Respect ancestral land ties now, property owners hating. Believe I explained this way of life is violating.
Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America, or what we better refer to as Turtle Island.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with an unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Oka, hello everyone. My name is Bon, which is short for Bonabella, and my pronouns are they, them. I'm super excited to be here and to collaborate with Indigenous Action. My perspectives come from being trans, disabled, and detribalized, and I'm excited to be co-hosting this show with Klee and Anthony, and super thankful for our guest for being here today.
Yat e she Klee dashajine, todich eatni shabashachin, auto nakudine dashanilla, shama e beethachi, auto beethachi dashache, tithijinde nasha, auto kintlenish shahawan. My name is Klee. I'm originally from Black Mesa on the Diné or Navajo Nation. Currently, I reside here in so called Flagstaff, Arizona. And I'm really excited about this show today. This broadcast, Indigenous Action, is something that we've actually been looking forward to a long time. And we just haven't carved the space out in our lives to bring all these powerful voices, fierce, unrelenting folks from the front lines of a range of different struggles that we've worked with, collaborated with over the years. So really honored to be able to share this with our co-host, Bon and Anthony, as well as the wonderful guests that we have lined up for you today.
This is your host, Anthony Choice Diaz, King Balam, a.k.a. the Sun Jaguar. And the intentions of Indigenous Action is a space that is not an academic space. It is an unoccupied space by not being a space at all, in which Indigenous people can be free to speak their minds about the issues and topics at hand. There's no such thing as safe spaces, so today we're going to talk about land acknowledgments, but first, let's introduce our guests and hear their initial thoughts on the matter.
All right, thank you, Anthony. So today, one of the people we have with us is Amara Solomon Jay, and she is a writer, activist, and educator of Mexican, Native American, and European ancestry. She is a transformative justice conflict mediator. She's the co-founder of Res Beats, which is a youth performance space. She's a member of the Center for Interdisciplinary Environmental Justice and a member of the Otham Anti-Border Collective. She currently works as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Riverside. So, Amara, did you want to share with us a little bit about your initial perspectives about land acknowledgments?
Sure. I think, like, what I see happening with the performative gesture of the land acknowledgement is that it's kind of taking the place of this thing that folks used to do more commonly, which was like bringing out some token Native person to do like an opening prayer. So everybody could feel like they were like, you know, at one with the earth and, you know, have this symbolic representation of like a cool Native New Agey person as a way of like, you know, somehow representing the diversity and inclusion of Indigenous peoples. And then they would have that person go away. and then their whole settler program would then continue without any Indigenous participation or reflection about what these settlers were doing on Indigenous land. And it was just really this performative gesture to kind of make it seem like a multicultural and diverse space. Like, we're acknowledging Indigenous people and we're going to, you know, make them analogous with the land, and then have them just kind of talk about, you know, or analogous with spirituality, and just have them talk about or perform their spirituality, or perform that this used to be their land, and then they're going to go away. And then we're going to go on doing settler things. And that's kind of how I see it, as, you know, the way that a lot of people are taking it up is that it's falls into this like idea of multiculturalism, that if you just kind of represent the diversity of Indigenous peoples, or if we just acknowledge, you know, that this that we're on Native land and we're including them, and that's all we need to do. And I don't see a lot of folks taking it any further than that. So it just becomes this very tokenizing gesture that continues to frame Indigenous peoples as being in the past and as being like, you know, this analogy to land or spirituality, but not complex, you know, people who can participate in the rest of the event or the rest of the doings. And so that's one of the main things that disturbs me about it. I also feel like it's just weird, like, to, you know, it's this kind of tokenizing gesture that I think should be for settlers, you know, to acknowledge that they stole some stuff and that they should give it back and then do the actions of giving it back. But what I see and what I've experienced myself, kind of being somebody who moves in different spaces, in cultural spaces and in activist spaces and academic spaces, is that because it's thought of by so many folks as just this inclusionary act, that they will ask the random Native person in the room to do it. Like, oh, you Native person, why don't you acknowledge the land that we're on? Because that's what Native people do in the program of this event. And it's like, no, this isn't for us. This is actually for settlers to do. And then it requires some type of action, like giving land back. And so that's, I think that's my main critique of it, is that it's just becoming another practice that's kind of co-opted and made into this vacant representationalism that doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah, and now we're going to hear from Alex Soto. Straight out of Autumn Jewett, Alex advocates for the rights of his community of Tohono O'odham and all Indigenous nations through hip-hop music, his writing, and his education. Moving beyond the isms and schisms, Alex seeks to inform the world at large of his people's struggles while empowering his community to take direct action. During the years Alex spent sharing his music around the world, he found the importance of culturally relevant information literacy. With the same passion Alex put into his music and land defense efforts, he now views Indigenous librarianship as a means to fundamentally empower Indigenous communities and to cultivate Indigenous modernity. Alex believes Indigenous librarianship synthesizes his creative, cultural, and professional backgrounds, as well as his commitment to Indigenous community building and Indigenous liberation. With all that, Alex, and we've known each other for years on many different fronts and front lines. What's your take on land acknowledgments?
Well, greetings, everybody. I guess offhand, you know, land acknowledgments to me, you know, when I first came across them and, you know, the spaces that we've shared throughout the years, Klee, I always thought it was a joke, you know, to hear these institutions, you know, put out these statements to make themselves feel good, I guess, to make them feel like they are able to check off a box on their liberal, you know, agenda, to be like, oh yeah, we acknowledge natives. And as we all know, it's bullshit, because if they wanted to do something more, there's plenty of things in their own departments, their own units, their own institutions that they could fundamentally address and make clear steps in the right direction to really be sorry and to really have a genuine relationship with Native people. So, I mean, I'm trying to think back when I first became aware of land acknowledgement statements, but for sure in the past 10 years, and usually, you know, they're issued at a very large level, you know, whether it's a state government, city government, or university. And it's very hard to, you know, really make sense of it at that point. I mean, at that level, they have the authority within that institution to do fundamental change, but they don't. So for the most part, I think it's all bullshit, to be blunt about it. But I will say, and or what was shared, or to share this point again, you know, I think in many ways it is for settlers. It is for non-Native people. And I think it's kind of sad sometimes when I see, you know, our own people kind of jump around these liberal, you know, fronts to act like it's, you know, like that's the end, you know, to everything. And I'm like, no, that's just step one, is to acknowledge these issues. And then whatever institution is, hold them accountable to whatever platform or whatever, you know, level of the institution they can offer. So, of course, on a state level, you can do a lot on the state level to rectify these injustices and so on. So, yeah, in many ways, these are truly meant for non-Native people. But at the same time, in terms of strategy, in terms of trying to agitate and push things that I think all of us on this call will, you know, advocate for and have done in our own lives, is that it is an entry point to really start having conversations, one, with their own people to establish, you know, what is the end game here? Are we just in the politics of recognition? Or are we in the politics of, you know, no politics, right, of liberation? And two, for settlers to really call them out on their so-called allyship. You know, if you want to be about it, well, here's an opportunity within that institution. If you're claiming to be an ally, well, do something, you know, be more than an ally, be an accomplice. So I think with these statements, it is an entry point to kind of see where people stand. Because once folks start putting these out, it's like, okay, well, what's up? You know, how are we? Where are we going to start, you know? And myself, in my current capacity in the field of libraries, I have noticed the importance in certain areas when you really break it down to more on the ground level compared to these larger institutional levels, to say, what can this particular institution do for us right now? What do we need and how can we use it? And at least in the world of libraries, I have been part of some efforts that are going in the right direction. But at the same time, I don't trust white folks for what they say. So hopefully, you know, they do actually make genuine steps in the right direction to rectify issues in the world of libraries and archives and Native people. But that's just one area. And I feel that in many ways, you know, we start at the bottom level, the ground up, and start to see these areas that we can intersect on, yeah, there's plenty of room for agitation. But if we're just going to have, like, say, the university pass something, well, you know, you better give our land back or get free tuition to Native students. Or, you know, if it's a city level, well, don't build freeways to destroy our sacred mountains and so on. So it's like really operationalizing these so-called white tears to do something. And I have some experience dealing within the institution trying to push forward, but at the same time, it is very draining. It's a lot of emotional labor, and it can really, you know, just drive you crazy if you let it. But at the same time, you know, I rather just, you know, just do what we got to do in as far as direct action and as far as outside of these institutions. But we are kind of caught in that bind where it's like, yeah, do we take advantage of it and milk it for what it is? Or do we just say fuck it all and let them, you know, fall on their own asses? But that's just my two cents.
Yeah. And we're going to, through this process, we're going to hear from a few voices from our guests. And then we're going to open it up to a general conversation. And our last guest that's going to weigh in before our open conversation with the hosts as well is Chijijak. And Chijijak is a Diné anarchist from Yat Eskide, a small town high school dropout currently working dead-end jobs in occupied Autumn lands. So we're spending a lot of time in this initial episode in Autumn lands, which is great. Chiji has no ambitions for climbing the toxic superstructural ladders of American civilization, including the self-righteous stepstool of leftist active careerism. Chiji's anarchy is the pursuit for a full autonomous life on the ruins of authoritarian infrastructure, free from the infringement of settlers, for Bidone and his homies. So welcome, Chiji. And again, we're talking about land acknowledgments.
Oh, yeah, it's Ankley. I was trying to think of something positive to say about land acknowledgements, but I can't. I agree that it's a performative gesture in lieu of something more meaningful, like settlers' claims and over indigenous lands, but I don't see it going that route. I mean, I think we'll see what usefulness land acknowledgements have based on their mainstream appeal. I mean, I don't know if we get to the point where, you know, the Cleveland Indians doing land acknowledgements right before Osei Can You See? You know what I mean? Anyway, that's where my only thoughts right now.
Yeah. The segue, of course, is our open discussion with all of us about achieving our own kind of art, you know, establishing our own views. And the way I look at it is, this is just, it's a perfect example of performative justice and rudimentary notions of anything that are typical of the United States. A perfect example is kind of like Occupy Wall Street, where the idea of class conflict gets reduced into this 1%, 99%, you know, calculus. This is kind of the same sort of thing, but the difference is, it isn't just reductionism of an entire history of multiple nations, the very nations that they're living on top of, but it's also a kind of chymistry, casting chimera and illusion over it to exactly like someone said, for it to be an illusion of complicity and that it's okay and then you never have to change anything. Where I come at it in my own work is different, where like I can only speak for myself, but in what I would like to see is when I do a land acknowledgement myself, I don't think of it in terms of spectator events. I think of it in terms of actually trying to create a foundational way of engaging with the indigenous native community of that area. And a perfect example was the first time I met Alex. Alex was coming hard about, you know, Phoenix being autumn land, you know, and I totally understood everything he was saying. And the issues that were at the time was myself contending with the history of people that didn't come that way. And instead it was basically an interpredatory indigenism, if you will, where you had indigenous people displaced from wherever they were from, and then just landing in a location and laying claim to it at the expense of the community that's already there. The problem is we don't have any formal structures that are nation to nation necessarily. How do we theorize that? And B, how do you function if it's just an individual thing? Like, I can say I'm cool with Alex. I cannot necessarily say that I'm cool with the Autumn Nation. And who is that under colonialism, since we have a neo-colonial leadership in many nations throughout the country?
Going back to what you were saying, Anthony, about how land acknowledgments are essentially just the most rudimentary way of understanding the land here in occupied America. And with that, I also think that it totally erases the relationship that Black slaves have to the land here as people who were violently taken away from, you know, Africa and the Caribbean and elsewhere and placed here. They formed a significant relationship with the people and the land here. And I never hear that being talked about in the conversation of land acknowledgments. And because of that, I think that and we experience a lot of anti-Blackness in these conversations and in specifically indigenous spaces. So I just thought it was really important during this conversation about land acknowledgments to also name that we can't have, again, like I said, Indigenous sovereignty without Black liberation and centering the voices of Black folks and their relationship to the land also is absolutely necessary.
It's really important, Vaughn, because, like, I think the ways that, like, these really simplified, like, uncomplex fumbles at attempting to have some type of liberational politics function is that folks just want to put each racial group into, like, this essentialist box, right? And so, therefore, Native people are associated with land, and Black folks are associated with, like, incarceration or enslavement, and that's it, you know, and people think that that's okay, but it actually reinforces those logics of genocide and enslavement, right? And so I think it's really troubling the way that Black folks are thought of as ungeographic, right? The place is not accessible to them, that home is not accessible to them through this genocidal settler state, right? And so I think that we need to disrupt that. And I think that there's a way to talk about place that can do that. But I don't see the land acknowledgement stripped form. You know, if we think of it as a performative form, I don't see it really doing that, you know, to talk about, well, what are our relationships with each other? You know, what are Native and Black relationships? What are Native and refugee or migrant relationships? You know, what are relationships that we could have that are not structured by settler colonialism and white supremacy and heteropatriarchy? Like, how can we actually have different relationships? But I like, Anthony, what you were saying is, like, there's a praxis we need to get towards that's about having those, like, alternative liberational relationships. And that's, I think, my critique of the land acknowledgement is I don't know if it gets us there, at least not the way I see folks doing it.
Land acknowledgements for me are about consent first and foremost. And it's not about, like, because what is happening in this performative allyship imposition of we see you in the politics of recognition, as you said, it's more of an acknowledgement of the people of the land. So when I break down an understanding of acknowledging the land, it has to be about consent. How does the land acknowledge us? How does the land have a relationship with us? Because this is what it is to be Indigenous. It means you're of the land. So we're talking about anti-Blackness and Black liberation being intertwined with that. But how do we configure or calculate in consent as well? And so the damage, the imposition of colonialism against all of our bodies and against the land is a part of the configuration of that. So we can acknowledge everybody's suffering to no end, but what and how does that reconcile the relationship that we have of violence, of this sort of, like, anthropocentric perspective on relationship to land? So I put it in this way as an actual experience that my father, Jones Benali, who is a Hathathli, had just a couple of years ago, and is a story that he repeated to me several times and explained in a really powerful way that he was with a crew down spending time with another Indigenous nation who had been experiencing severe weather issues, and it was harming their people. People were passing on. There was some serious conflict that was going on in disharmony in that area with nature. And they were sitting by a fire, having a conversation with some of the elders there, and a frog actually came up to my father and one of my nieces, and it just sort of sat by them, and it was just really intently looking at them and talking. And so frogs have a lot of symbolism in our traditional history. There's a lot of connection to moisture and rain and weather. And so my father just sort of stopped, and he offered a prayer, and then the frog talked and delivered a message and said that it was lonely, that it felt neglected, that nobody was talking to their people. And so there was this disharmony of neglect and the damage that had been done. And so things were so out of balance that the response was this imbalance that manifested through the weather conflict, and that was harming people. And so that message came. And to me, my father sharing that story was really powerful in the way that it was just like, are we listening to the land? Are we actually in, you know, when we talk about land acknowledgements, like even from our perspective as Indigenous people, again, beyond the performative allyship bullshit that we're talking about, how do we actually understand that? And what is the relationship that we have? And what is the consent? Because here as Diné people within the Four Sacred Mountains, we can articulate that through our history. And then when we have guests who come in and acknowledge that, you know, we recognize, okay, well, does that mean you recognize the challenges that we continue to face? Does that mean you just see us and you see our suffering, but you're not going to do anything about it or implicate yourself in any way, on any meaningful way, to address those ongoing violences against our peoples and against the land? And so to build a relationship with the people of the land who are still in relation with nature, who have that agreement, who have whatever, you know, covenants, sacred covenants, if you will, with nature. And that's how sort of my understanding through our cosmology is Diné folks have that. And to me, that's a part of the discussion that is really left out. We could talk about, you know, the complicated isms in politics on many different levels of identity, but like, have we even had consent with the land? You know, are we still talking and understanding the land in that way as a being, as an entity, and multiple entities with the spirit as well? And I think that that's part of the damage that we have to face and deal with. You know, to have somebody just go up at a university or on a stage, or, you know, even to declare Indigenous Peoples Day, to me, it's the same superficial thing. They get up there and they just give this sort of like scripted speech about what they, you know, how woke they are in this moment. And then everybody goes back as business as usual. But we actually aren't talking to nature and working with nature. You're not actually understanding and building that connection and actually seeing the people on the land and understanding the suffering and what we can do to maintain or restore what we need to have the balance in our lives in this universe. And so I think, you know, the conversation about land acknowledgements, yes, it's like, I think it's just obnoxious and superficial. The fact that you can go to a website or you can text a number, you know, somebody's devised this way of like mapping out, you know, Indigenous peoples whose lands you're on, like, is so disembodied. It's so disconnected that to me, that is like the dead end of allyship. It just shows how like hollow the performance is in this theater of, you know, settler consciousness building. And to me, that's part of the question is like, are we okay with, you know, conscious settlers, like with woke settler colonialism, you know, and what ways can we challenge, disrupt, and rearticulate the relationships that we have and make that meaningful, whether that's through implicating people in our struggles. And that's a lot of what I wanted to get out of this conversation, is to hear where y'all were at with your experiences and like how that can work beyond just this sort of like, you know, goodwill. You know, it's basically like extending Thanksgiving through the rest of the fucking year. And I'm not, you know, here for that at all. Of course, because of what that represents, it's disembodied from the actual people and actual realities and struggles that we continue to face. So I'll stop there because I have a lot to say, but.
Yeah, Klee, I really hear you. This is Vaughn. And like what you were saying, I think the land acknowledgements and in summation with everyone else's perspectives, it really like sets the tone for other mechanisms of performative allyship. Like for example, I had seen somebody wanting to learn Diné Bizad, and they don't actually even, they live here in occupied Kinklané, but they don't actually know any Diné people. And so when we get into this like territory of land acknowledgments, it just, and how pervasive it is now in academia and the nonprofit industrial complex and in other spheres, which cannot be decolonized through a land acknowledgement, we see how that then translates into other performances of wanting to connect to the idea of culture or maybe the idea of land, but it totally misses the mark because there are no actual real authentic relationships being built with the people or the land. And just quickly to address the apps that exist that where you can insert the zip code that you're in, and it populates the people whose land you're on, it totally ignores the relationship to territory of the land, and also creates more borders within Turtle Island, where we're seeing like certain zip codes, of course, represent you know, people who have historically lived here, but it just further draws lines in the sand between between the land and the folks who were the original caretakers of that space, and it ignores the inter-community relationships that were formed on the land between different tribes. And so it just further, in my perspective, it furthers the idea that lines can be drawn in the sand, and that is somehow representative of the people who occupy and caretake that land.
Yeah, I sort of have, I guess maybe I have the same frustrations and feeling that you have, Chijijak, and I'm curious to hear more about your pessimism around the politics of recognition, you know, maybe beyond land acknowledgments.
Well, I was mostly right now thinking about what you were introducing in regards to asking the land for some kind of consent on how to acknowledge the land. And it made me, you know, contemplate what little autonomy the earth is given in a lot of these, you know, politically driven conversations. It is, you know, very human-centric to make a lot of these decisions and excluding the land in that way. But like you were saying, it does push all of us to try to, I guess, really contemplate and reflect what our relationship to the land is beyond the land being something that's apart from ourselves. I mean, right? Was that kind of what you were getting at?
Yeah, definitely an element. I mean, and it, I guess it's like two separate points, because like, I'm sure like some New Agers would probably, or like anarcho-primitivists or green anarchists would be listening to this being like, oh yeah, all I need to do is talk to the land and get permission from the land to be here and that's it. And, you know, bypass indigenous folks. So, yeah. But that's not obviously right, the point.
Yeah, but also you need to name drop like the witchy anarchists and stuff like that.
Oh,
there's
are we
a lot
now?
Of those out there.
Yeah, identify them. I don't know if I'm going to ever name drop them unless I'm...
Yeah, that's probably I'm not a good desperate way to start the first podcast episode.
Yeah, and just like bringing it back to what you're talking about, Amra, like I think you really summed up a lot of, you know, my feelings regarding like the performance and how hollow it is. Like I'm really curious about, and perhaps I know there's elements that we could dig deep into, but like is there a role that settler colonizers, you know, could have and articulate on that level that would make that meaningful, or what ways could that be done from your perspective? And I'm curious to hear from you as well, Alex, on this.
I mean, I think that there's so much, right? I mean, part of it is like, you know, all of us, I think, at some level, but definitely settlers more, you know, but I speak for, you know, myself as somebody who's, you know, my family is kind of a little detribalized, a little disconnected from our traditions. Like, there's ways that we can all do better at unlearning extractivism, you know, and in the ways that we approach each other, the ways that we approach the land. And so I think that that's like the heart of the logic that I see operating when most people try to fumble through these interactions, is that there's still like this extractive core to it, like, which speaks to, I think, your issue of consent. Like, the earth is saying no, like, all the time, you know, they're just saying like, fuck no, all the time. And are we listening? And are we letting the earth say no? Are we okay with just leaving things alone or walking away when it's obvious that they're going to be detrimental? And I don't think many of us have that practice yet of, you know, being okay with not getting what we want, right? And knowing that that's a process of consent. So I think that's part of the relationship building that needs to happen is, you know, in some ways, I think sometimes I can be a little bit of an optimist where I've experienced, you know, deep solidarity that was meaningful and material and real, where people, you know, really were trying to burn some shit down together and intentional about that. And I think that it's possible, but I think that there's so much that we need to do before we can even get started on that. And I think it's interesting, like I was kind of laughing at the last comment, because there's, you know, folks are just always looking for like this cookie cutter answer of like, okay, I can just, you know, do this and that's gonna, you know, let me be a cool anarchist or, you know, be able to do what I want to do still. And it's like, no, the whole point is you don't get to do what you want to do, you know, and we need to start there.
Well, I guess from my perspective, it is multiple folds here. You know, I think on a larger scale, you know, in terms of liberation, in terms of real solidarity and really having that true understanding of where you're at and starting with the land, I honestly don't think any English, you know, document, you know, Eurocentric, you know, language is going to summarize that connection. And I feel that that's not going to go beyond the politics. It's always going to be politics when it's described in that way. And just thinking back, like in my own experiences in libraries and archives, you know, it's very daunting to think a land statement, or if you're an Indigenous person and you see these land statements, on one hand, your reaction is very pessimistic, which is, oh, well, they're acknowledging us. What are they going to actually do? Or two, you know, does that mean that I have to go over there and show them how to do this work and show, like, be the token person and, you know, put that time and energy and get exploited and then probably just get watered down to the point where they're just going to co-opt it and make it a very white response to a land statement. So I guess on one hand, I just don't think land statements in the long run are going to do anything other than just acknowledge, you know, as far in terms of liberation. But on a more micro level, I'd say you were to operationalize those statements on something that can actually be practical, that can actually be empowering and be strategic for the current generation and beyond, I think they are useful as a way to hold, if you're willing to, and this is the key word, if you're willing to try to engage the process. But I mean, if you're starting at a state level, it's like by default, give us our land back, you know, or institutional level, like a university, it's like same thing. Give us our land back and get free tuition and so on and so on. But when you break it down on a department level, unit level, possibly, you know, I'm kind of in the middle of a process like that. And I think a lot of what we discussed so far is, yeah, as settlers looking at this, I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But for the Native people that are in these conversations who mean well, who want to try to use it for their own advantage, you know, I'm just curious how those folks will be able to utilize it. Because, example, if there's a land statement and there's like no Native people in that institution, that says a lot. That says, oh, wait, you don't even support the people that you're actually advocating for. And I know on a micro level, I'm not asking for anything because they ain't going to do shit. But on a micro level, I'm just curious that how that can actually be empowering for folks to make space, to empower folks to have access to podcasts like this, or, you know, critical, you know, information and knowledge, and whether that's, you know, more on the anarchist side of it, or even our own life ways, our own people, our own knowledge systems, you know. And I speak to that as a librarian, as an archivist, to say there is access there. And a land statement can be a way to help really blow up or really expand those spaces for Native people to access that. But if it's not, then yeah, it is performative. It is strictly for show. It is strictly just something that can be used for their own, you know, accolades, and not really on the ground. And I'm currently witnessing that now at a university, where they're at a place where they can really prove that they can do something on that micro level in this particular unit around libraries and archives, or it's this bullshit. And I'm very careful how I use my energy in this conversation, but it's like, yeah, I want to have more support, but at the same time, I'm not going to tokenize myself to get it either. So I don't know. That's kind of more on the ground, because I think a lot of what we're talking about on a macro level, yeah, I mean, we could go on about how much is bullshit, but like on the ground, how can they be used as a way to agitate? And if they can't, then yeah, move beyond that.
Can I chime in?
Go for it.
This is Anthony. sorry. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yeah.
I'm actually really appreciative for this discussion, because it really gets me thinking, because I don't have a land to necessarily say that is mine. My land is in the middle of Central America, and as far as my family is concerned, we've actually lived in the same location since before the Spanish came. And so it's just a small little village. But, and so in a strange way, like on the one hand, I realize that I'm here as an indigenous person. I'm here as an indigenous person looking for cues from other indigenous people as to how to interact where I'm at. That's a sense of place, right? Versus land in the anthropomorphic sense. So I'm really glad that was brought up, because I think that that's a whole other complexity of this idea of land acknowledgments, and how, whether or not we personally want to engage in it is immaterial, but it is a political space, and it's one that can be squandered and probably has been squandered, and in that it's been left to become what it's become. Because by the same token, we could do different things. This to speak to direct action, the notion of direct action in the sense, is like, why, like, it's almost like, why not be with a person that doesn't leave the stage? And or school them on exactly what the land is saying. Because the other part of it is, exactly as someone said, that no one's listening to the land, and by all accounts, that's what we're supposed to be doing as indigenous people. And if we're actually doing the listening, then that means we have to do the advocacy as well. And unfortunately, the way the land acknowledgement works is it works at this multiple levels, where one, it's this generic geographic statement that kind of disavows historical amnesia by saying, hey, we acknowledge you. By the same token, it's supposed to be dealing with the notion of victimhood and relationship to a tribal nation. And either specific or in the broad sense of the term. And then a third level is exactly what Klee said, which is about the land itself, which actually has no voice at all. And so instead we're caught in like the first two items and never getting to the deeper ones, let alone the idea of actually physically decolonizing space. So in my own thinking, I was looking at it going, well, that's a very good question. I've never even thought of it in terms of speaking on behalf of the land, if that makes sense. For one, it's not my land. But for two, I wasn't thinking in that framework, because the notion of liberating the land is actually framed in a completely different context than looking at as our relationship to something that's speaking to us and has its own opinion and its own responses, which everyone is clearly seeing.
It makes me wonder, kind of like, you know, in the direction that we're heading, it sounds like, how to really like foster that like relationship and that connection. And I think that in my experience as someone who's who is detribalized and was Americanized through the foster care system, I'm almost kind of left with a complete lack of like understanding about how to do that. And I think in a sense, I might have some hesitation too, because like toxic traditionalism has informed, you know, in my experience as a detribalized person, that in order to connect to the land, I have to be part of certain ceremonies that I don't necessarily have access to, especially as like a queer trans person in a place that, you know, on my homelands where transphobia and homophobia are rampant, as well as racism towards the so-called Mexican Cocoa Pop people, of which I am. And so it's really interesting, you know, because the Cocoa Pop people are the river people of the so-called Colorado River, which here in occupied King Kalani I live really close to. But when I go to my homeland, it's basically just like a swampy canal because of all of the dams. And so I have a relationship to the Colorado River that folks, because I have access to it, that Cocoa Puff folks in our homelands don't necessarily. And so it just really like begs the question of how people, you know, 500 years after the occupation of Turtle Island, how do we really do that? Or do we even, or can we, or do we just kind of, you know, occupy these so-called anti-spaces and claim those as our connection to space?
Bon, I just wanted to follow up with the term toxic traditionalism, just to break that down a bit for folks who might not have an understanding of that, who are listening to this show. And also, I know you unpacked it a little bit, but maybe you could flesh it out a little bit more for people who might not have a sense of what that is or what you mean by that.
Sure. So I, like I said, I always like speak on these things from my personal experiences, and what that translates for me is, you know, a lot of gatekeeping around like what it is to claim indigeneity and who can claim indigeneity. And I've seen that manifested as folks gatekeeping the experience of being an indigenous person by, you know, having to have done a certain amount of ceremonies or being able to speak the language or being able to, you know, even name your clans. And there's some folks of smaller tribes who don't have clans anymore. They were completely erased. And then we've also seen that manifested in the way that toxic masculinity and patriarchy and the heteropatriarchy has embedded itself into like so-called traditional ways of being, where we see like queer people, femme people, women not necessarily taking up the roles or the space that that they would have pre-contact. And so we see toxic traditional mindset kind of like further oppressing and using kind of like colonial information and that colonial like embeddedness into the ways that we operate as Indigenous people today, furthering the oppression of many Indigenous folks. So that's kind of how I've understood it so far.
Sounds like we're going to have to do a whole show on that.
Down.
Yeah, I mean, mainly because I like hear, like, I hear some of the Indigenous Marxists or MLMers out there, like Marxist Leninist Maoist, use that same term, and it to some degree meaning the same thing, but also using it in a different way that's actually weaponized against, like, you know, folks who are maintaining traditional cultural knowledge systems. So I'd be interested in deep diving into that conversation more.
Based on what was shared around, like, what does indigeneity look like in light of this, the how it's weaponized, you know, the I like to refer to folks who do that, you know, as neo-traditionalists who, you know, have this vanguard of how things need to be and, you know, uphold some a system in place to really, you know, uphold their power, not really empower the community and even their own family members. And just thinking in terms of that, back to the initial question around land statements, you know, I do see that as Native people, we're at various different places in our where we're at growing and learning. And some of us, you know, are born and raised on the res and, you know, had a grandpa and grandma and elders around to really show those ways. And there's others who were urbanized and everywhere in between. And I feel for those who are in the middle, you know, those who may not have those direct ties to their homelands and, you know, their roots, will say, you know, in these, you know, not cities, but shitties that we have out here, you know, these areas of settler, you know, growth, you know, we have these institutions that mark, you know, parade around diversity initiatives and inclusiveness. And, you know, whether that's a Black Lives Matter statement or a land statement, you know, it's like, well, what are you actually doing to help the community out? So if we're on the front line, you know, in terms of knowledge, places of knowledge and places of information, you know, although a university is a university, it is still a place for folks to get that access to that information, or whether that's a people's school, you know, whether that's hip hop education, whatever form of education. Unfortunately, how it's rigged up now, it inherently has these institutions that are running around talking about land statements, talking about Black Lives Matter statements. So it's very hypocritical of him to do that without finding some way to support that. So, you know, that being said, I feel like, you know, for those who are willing to fight that fight, and it's not everybody, I definitely could see what others fighting on the actual front line, not these academic front lines and all these other spaces that we all land up in. We can use these statements to at least as a starting point. And if they don't want to play ball, then you call them out for what it is and move on, you know. But I will say there are some good whites there and there, and probably that's not the thing to say on this call, some good accomplices, you know, there and there that can help us, you know, leverage those resources, you know. And I'm speaking as a librarian and an archivist, like, there's so many times I've encountered Native students who are grateful to have access to language material, grateful to have access to their people's history. And on one hand, as a person who's been semi-raised traditional, I always kind of like, I feel kind of weird, you know, or just being in that moment, because like I could think of times in my life where I've heard this knowledge directly from an elder or like back in my home community in Autumn Jovet, you know. But at the same time, I have learned a lot through books. I have learned a lot through archives. I have learned a lot about language and Western format. So when I see those moments and I see a space like where I'm at now, I'm like, yeah, this needs to be double, triple the size to have access to this information. And if this institution wants a land statement, well, you better support Indigenous knowledge systems. You better support Indigenous information professionals who can access this information. But that's for those who want to be in this shitty, these shitty institutions. Because I have learned in the past 3 or 4 years, it's kind of my own involvement with things, you know, for sure, as a rapper, as someone that is hanging around with some of y'all on this call, you know, doing real smashy, smashy shit. You know, it's like on one hand, I know that's important. But on the other hand, what I'm also doing now has value for those who need that access. And so for these folks who want to, these institutions who want to have access or have a land statement, you know, it's like, well, put up or shut up. Because if not, you're just wasting my time and you're pretty much showing you don't give a fuck about us. You know, so either we got to find our own people's library or we got to go back to the land and learn. But that's just kind of that connection, because many folks who are missing that connection to their indigeneity, they come to these places. And I think it's very important to offer those spaces to those folks.
Hey, Alex, that actually makes me think of something that I've been wanting to ask you. As an Autumn person, you know, how in my experiences of running around in non-political circles that I run around in, I have felt a need to sort of acknowledge an area that I'm in and that might not be, you know, acknowledging Autumn land first. For example, you know, there are communities that might recognize Finiquera instead of, you know, Phoenix. And there's also communities like in South Phoenix that might recognize their area as Bird City and not necessarily Phoenix. And, you know, these are non-white people. And I mean, just to give an example, you know, I used to would go in certain neighborhoods and, you know, write on walls and whatnot. And I ran into these conflicts where I would felt a need to, you know, have everybody in the neighborhood acknowledge that it's Autumn land, because there was a sense of Chicano nationalism in these areas that would look at this land as an extension of Aztlan. And a lot of the conflicts that came out of these activities was that, you know, some people ended up, you know, not acknowledging Aztlan, but they would talk about Finiquera and Bird City. And I just wondered what you thought about those kind of dynamics that exist outside of the political conversations.
I was like the first meeting I had with Alex.
What was that?
I said it sounds like the first meeting I had with you.
So, oh yeah, that tends to be the first meeting all the time, you know, folks. Not just you.
Yeah, I know.
You're actually that was a better conversation back then compared to the ones about the site. But I think as an Autumn person, when I hear about land statements. And then to your question, you know, around, you know, other references to areas on the globe, you know, whether it's a neighborhood or a region and so on, you know, on one hand, at the end of the day, as an Autumn, I know this is our land. You know, at the end of the day, I know this is Acoma Autumn land up here and Thona Autumn down there and all the way down to the border. And when I'm up north, you know, it's Diné and Hopi and so on. You know, so I think when you're native, you just kind of, you just know you have that truth, that knowledge, you know. But when I see non-natives or even some natives perpetuate neocolonialism, it is very frustrating where, you know, I get this, the cultural pride. I get the, you know, how the state has, you know, really broken our communities up in a way where we have these different subsets of different areas and, you know, whether, of course, the first land grab with our own native land, to then the placement of African Americans and Mexican Americans and other people of color, you know, displaced in urban cities, you know, and to have the hood, you know, to have the barrio, whatever, however you refer to it. So on one hand, I understand why it is the way it is, and I don't take too much of offense when I talk to, you know, friends and people I know from those areas, because that's what they know. And that's, they're not saying it in a way to be disrespectful or try to make a land grab, we'll say. You know, if anything, a lot of those people, when you start talking to them, they are very open to what I have to say. And, you know, they maybe have a general understanding. The people I have issues with, and to Anthony's comment right now, is those who are now weaponizing it for some political gain, you know, to rewrite the history books, you know, to rewrite, you know, these westernized ways of labeling the land. Because one, I think that's ridiculous, because as to the point in the beginning with Klee, you know, it's like the land knows, you know, the land is connected in a way that we don't even understand as human beings. You know, the land knows us as Otham, and, you know, we're here. But for those who want to have some type of theory or some political ism and schism and all that, I just think it's pathetic. You know, they're just trying to really justify their bullshit. And, you know, to the point where it gets pretty ugly at times, where I've been in situations just repeating things my own grandparents have told me, and against some Maoist or some, you know, communist or some whoever, you know, trying to make some point about how this is Aslan or this is whatever. And it's like, no, this is Otham land. And if you don't understand that, I'm not here to hold your hand to make you understand it, you know? So it is frustrating, but I've gotten to a point in life where I just kind of let that shit go, because at the end of the day, they look like idiots. But it's just disheartening, you know, that for all these people who want to be woke, all these people who want to, you know, have this point to prove, it's like, you can't even listen to the land. You can't even listen to the people of the land. You can't even listen to even a institutional land, you know, whether that's the institution is a land statement saying this is Otham land, you're just that ignorant, you know, like, and that's, I think, partly why I'm kind of doing what I'm doing now, because of the power of the archives, the power of libraries, when they come from our own communities, when they're from Eurocentric perspectives, then we got issues. But when it comes from the people, it's a different story. So that's kind of my two cents on it. But yeah, it is kind of lame when I hear folks who don't know any better, you know, and they get brainwashed, or they get they start drinking the wrong Kool-Aid of what's what. And yeah, that's just what I've learned to experience. And it sucks, but I just learned to let it go at times, too.
I'm curious as to your perspective, Amra, in the spaces that you work in, what your response is to that, like how you relate to that. Especially because, you know, you have your foot in the academic world and in organizing, community organizing.
I think, like, on the one hand, like, I think a lot of nationalisms are inherently heteropatriarchal and problematic. So that's where a lot of times, like, I come up into some of those issues, especially around, like, the Chicano nationalism. It's always, like, a dude who wants to tell me, you know, something about the land or the place and, like, you know, claim it. And I think that that's the problem is when we run into those folks who take something like an ancient migration story that may or may not even directly relate to them and their own ancestors, but they want to take it literally in terms of giving themselves, like, privilege and place and the ability to kind of talk over other people. That's always problematic. But I think, like, what I find that is useful, and I think just drawing, like, from my own experience, what I've had to learn is how to be a good relative and how to be an accomplice if I'm not in my homeland. And that's a practice that I think we can work on, you know, we can all work on together. Like, you know, my family is from the Yuma area. You know, my family was there, you know, in the turn of the century as, you know, exploited indigenous labor. And Yuma is, like, a complicated place. place, I think, because it's often one of those places that reinforces, like, what Vaughn was suggesting, that, you know, when we do these simple land acknowledgements, like, it'll be the reservation boundaries that are acknowledged, but not the fact that numerous Indigenous peoples have stories and sacred relations to the sacred elements of that place. So, you know, Yuma has Kokopa and Kisan folks, but also has Chiasset Atom folks, Yoame folks have a relationship to that area, Kumeyaay folks have a relationship to that area, Mojave folks have a relationship to that area. There's names in the languages for the sacred sites in all those different languages, right? And so I think that when we're in each other's land and we're having, trying to have, like, you know, good relationships with each other that are in solidarity, you know, we can acknowledge that the land recognizes multiple people, and that we can, you know, recognize each other in a way that doesn't reinforce, like, colonialism or nationalism. Like I think about, you know, the thing that always was weird to me about, like, being asked, and in academic spaces, I'm so upset with it, because I often get asked to do the land acknowledgement for some settler. Like, I was at a conference last year, and the person who was giving, like, the presidential keynote, like, just kind of whispered to me, like, as an aside after my presentation, like, oh, I guess I should do a land acknowledgement with my keynote. Whose land am I on? Can you tell me about these people real quick? And I'm like, you've been planning this for how many years? And you flew all the way here and you couldn't look at Google? Like, no, I'm not going to do that for you just because my presence here as an Indigenous person suddenly reminded you of something you should have done. Like, no. So that's, like, the way that I encounter it in the university and in academic places. And that's why I'm so anti the practice. But when she said that, I was like, you know, like, if we're traditionally introducing ourselves to each other before we're about to get started to do something, I wouldn't necessarily refer to, you know, a site in the area or my relationship with the land. I would tell you, you know, who my grandparents were. I would tell you, you know, what village that we're from. And I would tell you, you know, this larger history about our long-term relationship of responsibility and accountability to the sacred in our community and our family. And that's a way of, you know, acknowledging and introducing ourselves to each other. And I think that, you know, some of us can't do that, you know, because those relationships have been severed. But there's different ways that we can tell our stories of how we got to the place that we are in, you know, and what our experience has been, and how we can positionalize ourselves to acknowledge the different relationships to settler colonialism that we might have, and relationships to land and space that we might have. And I think if we can start there, then that's just a better starting point. That lets us think about, okay, this is how we got here. This is how you got here. This is who you are. This is where you're coming from. Okay, now how can we work together to undermine these systems, to burn them all down, to do something, you know, different and liberational? And that's what, like, I have tried to learn, and what I try to kind of push other folks in activist spaces to do, because, you know, I just feel like it's like an act of making everything dead. Like, when we just kind of want to acknowledge the land as if it's this object, or the people who were here as if they're an object in the past, rather than think about our own complicity with how we got here.
And we are wrapping up time. We have, I think, like, a little over 15, 16 minutes left. So perhaps we can shift, I don't know how you want to shift this, Bon or Anthony, into, like, a bit of a closing.
I can do that. I wanted to go from the idea, kind of away from the abstract to the more concrete. I mean, the notion of land acknowledgments itself did not derive from this kind of liberal, generic nodding space. It actually came out of New Zealand, Aotearoa, and it had to do with the Treaty of Watenga, which basically was saying, this is our land. And there was a so, and actually, when they do it, it's actually a legal statement in terms of the of acknowledging actual treaty agreements that are still in contention. It isn't like here where the U.S. government just tosses treaties away as if they never existed. This relates to one key thing, which is that fundamentally what it all comes down to is either a diplomatic solution or a solution based on revolt and resistance. In that regard, that's where our African American brothers and sisters, our Black brothers and sisters, they actually function as what an ally really is versus how the nonprofit industrial complex has sold that idea as being kind of a standby fair weather friend. Whereas a real ally is someone that you actually have some form of contract with, because in order to break with that would be to act against the interests that you're actually agreed on. and the agreement has been, a tacit agreement's existed since the first conquistador got here and then the first slave got here, because we've been in active resistance against a very clear predatory, we can call it an impulse, you can call it a civilization, you can call it whatever. All I know is it leaves a scar behind it. And like Buddha said, and shitty's in their place. And so my question is, like, in, if we were to theorize the future, what does that future look like in terms of resistance, particularly in the climate that we're in, where as far as damaging the land, if we go to the grandiose sense in terms of the earth, we're doing more this country is doing more damage than, you know, anyone else in the world, and it seems intent on not stopping it. So where do you see the roles of indigenous nations in that?
I don't know. I wonder sometimes about this term nation, right? Like, you know, it can be strategic, and I understand the history of it being strategic through treaties and through resistance, but it's a fundamentally Western concept, and is that really what we're trying to rebuild? Like, regenerate. I don't know. You know, I don't know that a nation is necessarily something I want to be a part of.
To be clear, I meant nation in an abstract sense versus, you know, tribe.
I think that question is for everybody, right?
I'm not sure I'm really into theorizing the future generally, so I'm not sure how much I could contribute.
What's your theory of the anti-future then?
I mean, there's a personal part of me that believes that future generations, you know, have their own autonomy to decide what that future looks like, what their present would look like. And I would just, I always feel like my role is to make sure that future generations are free to do so.
I guess, like, as far as more on to actualize a lot of this, I guess that's what I've been trying to share is, you know, on one hand, we can be dismissive of these statements because all the reasons we talked about today. And I totally agree with that. And I see the limitations of it and how it plays into these narratives that marginalize us even more, you know. But on the other hand, you know, back to some of what I've shared earlier, it's like, well, if we have people who look like us in these spaces who are willing to fight the good fight in certain areas, depending on what it is and what can be, you know, moved forward on, you know, in my opinion, I feel like it's might be semi-strategic to have people in there to agitate in those spaces if they're willing to. But if not, then yeah, that's the alternative. That's the back to, you know, the theory, you know, trying to see what's beyond. But for right now, you know, like, I'll just say in the institution I employed for, with, like, I'm trying to milk it for what it is, and be like, you need to support Native and Indigenous knowledge systems. You need to support spaces for Natives. You need to support more resources. And if you don't, then you're full of shit. And, you know, you can't play into your so-called university charter. You can't now, you know, say you're an ally, you know, and that's where these folks are at, is allyship on that larger institutional level. But I will say so far in my experiences, it seems like folks are listening and definitely have gone through the emotional labor to, you know, explain the importance of what I'm saying to you all here and getting some good results out of it. But at the same time, these are institutions. They can change their mind tomorrow morning. It's all a waste of time and waste of effort. And why did I even bother? So it is, to me, a fine line of how much time and energy and who you are as a person and what you're willing to put up, depending on where you're at in your own lives. But, you know, it's difficult, you know, and that's the part where I think, you know, for folks who are new to this conversation, right? It's like, oh, a land statement, I'm, you know, making a difference, or this is a step in the right direction. It's like, it can be, but that, I mean, that's just the start. That's just the beginning. If you really want to talk about it, it's talk about it based on the level that statement was issued. And to what I mentioned earlier, on a more micro level, like, I've been, you know, through libraries and archives, like, there's plenty of things that we can do right now in the institution I work for to operationalize things that support Indigenous lifeways, that support Indigenous cultural sovereignty, that support, in my opinion, liberation once you have access to this information. And that's that long haul game where it's not going to happen tomorrow night. It's not going to happen next year. You know, this is going to happen 50 years down the line. So, like, in order to do that, we're going to have those resources to best preserve and mediate that knowledge. But if not, then yeah, then we're just, we need to get all Zapatista about it. And that's kind of been my stance lately. It's, you know, if we're going to do it, let's do it. You know, I think Klee, remember those times and circles we've been in where I was definitely at that place in life to do these things. But unfortunately, well, friends got co-opted, or folks turned liberal, or people get caught up in some, like, Marxist, socialism and all that stuff. So it's like, well, if you're not going to be about it, then I have to now cloak the work into this institution to ultimately get what the resources we need. And it's not about me. It's the folks after me. You know, it's the next generations, at, you know, moving forward. So I think these statements can be weaponized if done right. But, you know, that means it's not a statement anymore. It's actual action. And that is my opinion on that.
Yeah, I'm interested in, like, what a militant land acknowledgement is. Not just looks like, but, you know, there's a certain element of performance where, and perhaps a certain part of, like, in my optimism that, you know, is connected to what you're talking about, Anthony or Alex, where we have, you know, it's just like sort of like addressing mascot issues. And this is really the realm of identity politics for the most part, which is interesting that that term hasn't been brought up while we're talking about something that it's very much, you know, tied to it. And I think that this element of what is called virtue, or recognized as virtue signaling, where there's the superficial sort of like, hey, we're woke, look at us, we recognize that there's just been horrific acts of genocide, and these are the people's lands we're on, and there's no deeper commitment. And I think that question of commitment, the question of, like somebody said, contract, the question of, like, you know, making something meaningful when you're acknowledging such immense suffering is part of the key. And so to make that militant, I think, is my interest, because, you know, we could just have, like you said, you know, the some kind of weird football game or some kind of state, you know, extravaganza or settler colonial celebration where they do a land acknowledgement as a checkbox, then they move on to the next thing. And so there's no, you know, deep commitment to actually addressing what the political, well, I should just say relationships of power are, and how to, you know, how folks are making moves to change that beyond just lip service. And so I really, I think, like, if anything, like, even just having this conversation in this way, it can open up some of those, some folks who would otherwise just, you know, feel good about that and just uncritically want to build that settler consciousness. So settlers are just so self-aware that they recognize, you know, wherever they go, they magically can understand whose indigenous lands they're on. But, you know,
the game of guilt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like Monopoly in some ways, like this activist, allyship Monopoly. And, you know, like which indigenous people's lands have you, you know, collected so you can acknowledge them, like trading cards or something. And to me, it'd be interesting to envision, you know, what ways that, you know, can be a step into radicalizing anti-colonial struggle. So you know, finding that space where we, you know, intervene in the narratives, and just like I think Anthony said at the beginning, where, you know, perhaps at some point where there's a land acknowledgement that has been asked of somebody, like you, Amra, have been asked so many times before, where you get on the stage and you don't leave the stage. You know, you hold onto the mic because there's something critical happening in your community, and that's where the priorities, that's where the focus needs to be shifted to. So I think it's interesting because I'm not interested in performance and entertaining this settler gaze, which is mostly is the white gaze. You know, building meaningful relationships, understanding exchanges, and having a sense of like consent is key in addressing the power relationships, because we can acknowledge how bad everything is, how fucked up everything is, but if we're not doing a damn thing about it, it changes nothing. It's meaningless. And to me, that's where I see the trouble is here, because it is another dead end of identity politics with, you know, just signaling how woke settlers are and proceeding into this point where we are going to have, like, you know, a political extravaganza that is patently fascist, you know, or you can imagine like the most extractive, you know, industry, you know, corporation doing a land acknowledgement at some, you know, fundraising gala or something like that. And that to me is, I feel the same way about that, the way that nonprofits are doing, you know, these land acknowledgements, or that people in these, you know, small municipalities are doing it, or even sometimes at small functions where people are doing it. And you can clearly see that they don't give a shit. They don't care. They're not interested in building meaningful relationships with indigenous folks. There's no consultation leading up to the event, like you said, Amra, that they have no relationship and no interest in building those relationships on any meaningful basis to address these issues that we're talking about. So I just wanted to sort of like, you know, share that and just, you know, hopefully for our listeners, this will be in some ways a call to action and intervention, either personally or outwardly in organizing on some level, because I think there's lots of space to create a disruption. Like, and how else can we do land acknowledgements? Can it be through street art? Can it be through like fucking shit up in intervening with direct actions to challenge the narratives and rearticulate how we do these quote unquote land statements or acknowledgements as well. And I think that could be an interesting space of exploration beyond banner drops, you know? So yeah, just wanted to put that out there, but I'm curious as to your thoughts as well, Bon.
Yeah. I really, like, to echo what you said, I really do hope listeners, like, intervene and take action on this, because I really don't know about you all, but I am so fucking sick of conversations in our space, or anti-space, if you will, centering on settlers and centering on whiteness and centering on white supremacy culture. Like, I'm fucking done talking about white people and how white people, for centuries and decades, like, just cannot just fuck off. And I want to start talking about mutual aid. Like, I want to start talking about how we're going to live in this continued apocalypse that we're living in. You know, I hear a lot of people saying, oh, we're like entering into apocalypse, or this is like living in a dystopia. And like, we already have been living that post-apocalyptic life for centuries now. And so we've never had like time to collectively heal from like our experiences. And so I really want to be able to stop talking about white people and stop talking about white supremacy culture and start talking about how we're going to actually build that relationship with the land, how we're actually going to live communally, and how we're actually going to like live without these systems in place that where we're like forced to be dependent on. And so that's kind of like my final thoughts on everything.
Chiji Jack.
Well, Klee, I'm listening to the earth right now. And I think the best land acknowledgement is maybe just anarchy, just total liberation of the earth, black and indigenous people, starting with the abolition of the white race and total destruction of industrial capitalism. Those are my final thoughts.
I'm trying to figure out if you're being sarcastic or not.
Half and half.
Yeah, I guess the last thing I would say is that, like, I don't think that, I guess, representational gestures are completely useless. So, you know, but I think about, like, you know, the question that you just offered, like, how could this be an agitation? And I think, you know, I think if the way that we're talking about the land when we, you know, we want to go into these conversations, or the, you know, we want to think about how do we relate to each other, how do we relate to the space, like, I think we can have another set of questions, which is not like just what has been the past that's happened to this place, because that's often how it's framed. You know, who was here, you know, what happened, you know, who stole the land? Okay, let's just acknowledge that that's like an event in the past. And then let's go on and continue to do like problematic shit right now. And I think maybe there's a different way of framing our questions, you know, that we come into the room with. And maybe acknowledgement is, you know, not anything that we should be doing, because I feel like just the term acknowledgement, it just means like inclusion, you know, and I don't necessarily want to be included in whatever other folks are doing, especially if it's just, you know, the same old NGO industrial complex, academic industrial complex stuff. Like, I would rather burn that shit down, you know. So what are the questions that can lead us there? You know, what are we coming into this space wanting to destroy? What are we coming into this space committing ourselves to dismantle? And how are we going to do those things? Who needs to be present? Who can we build with? How can we build with them in a non-toxic way? You know, those are questions that I'm more interested in talking with people through, rather than doing any type of, you know, performative gesture about, you know, whose face should be here, you know, or who do we claim we're centering, like, you know. And I think that maybe we just need to shift away from the language of acknowledgement completely to get there. That's just one of the things that I've been thinking through.
Alex was using the term state land statement. Does that, you know, satisfy that concern?
Well, it depends, you know. Like, what are you, you know, what are you stating? Like, I think, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if the title gets us to where we're going. I think it's more like, you know, we're all, I think I would make this assumption that all of us here are interested in action, and that's the place we want to start. Like, what are the actions that we're taking? You know, if there's a land action on the agenda, I might be down for that.
Well, Klee, I guess for my part, the close, I guess what the way I see it is, you know, the size of the institution that is, you know, putting out these statements really decides like the level of outcomes we expect. And my opinion on a governmental, like state city level, I really don't see them doing shit, because they're just not going to truly have outcomes that are really meaningful and really supportive of what we're talking about here today. But on the other hand, starting to say, for example, a university is also in that same boat, but I can see departments within those universities, really, if they really were meaningful about it, they could examine, well, what can we do to fix what we've done that had started with our loss of land, you know, the theft of land from Native people, and really look at a decolonial initiative within that unit or department to want to be meaningful about it and not just have fluff and some statement. And as far as the wording of statement, I mean, I honestly, if it's a statement, if it's a manifesto, if, you know, however folks want to word it, you know, I'm all for action too. And so I don't, you know, if that's how white folks, institutions have to word things and frame things, so be it. But like, how are you actually going to then move on those particular initiatives on a policy level? Because that's the way these people talk, on policy points, bullet points, and what does that look like? So to your question earlier about what does that look like, at least in my realm of things, that looks like repatriation of material that's culturally sensitive back to tribes, which I'm part of that process now, mediating in between tribal communities here in Arizona to give back archival material and material that has contained traditional songs that obviously were stolen or unrightfully without consent given to the university at one point, but now using the protocols for Native American archival material, which is an international guidelines to rectify that. This university at least is trying to now make those steps in the right direction. So although that's not our land back, on a cultural sovereignty level, I see that as very important to help heal these wounds that this the land is now filling as an autumn. To hear those songs only be played or, you know, viewed or listened to in an autumn setting, not at the university. So I'll at least say that this particular institution is going in the right direction. Like I mentioned earlier, that could change tomorrow based on white folks, you know, and I'm not here to talk about white folks. I'm here to talk about what as Native information professionals can do to help lead this conversation, because a lot of the land statement has been used to advocate for more folks from my background, our backgrounds, to be able to say what needs to be said in these spaces that were never meant for us. And that also looks like meaning to have more funding and resources for community-driven archives to help us tell our own story, to preserve our own story. But that's on the level of work I'm doing. So those are clear outcomes that an institution can do and very attainable, in my opinion. So that's just how it can be used. But, you know, on a larger level, I mean, we're talking about larger outcomes and responses. So I just wanted to share that because it is, to some degree, a little practical, but it just depends on what size of the institution, what's the size of the institution, and do we have people who are willing to fight the fight who look like us? But that's my two cents.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. And thank you to all of our guests. That's the end of this broadcast today, but definitely not the end of the conversation, as we invite everybody who's listening to bring this into your organizing spaces and challenge, disrupt, confront settler colonialism and settler colonial mentalities, and find meaningful ways to build in our organizing. And so really grateful to our guests who have brought their on-the-ground analysis from the communities they're organizing in. Thanks so much, Alex. Thanks so much, Amra. Thanks so much to Chizajack, as well as our co-hosts. Thank you so much, Anthony and Bon. We, with Indigenous Action, our plan is to really bring deeper conversations, deeper critical analysis, and inform action. And we're all coming from a space where we have organized for years. We've been writing, working on stuff since Indigenous Action has been formed in 2001, and we're bringing that in the form of a podcast. Also, just one more shout out to Alas with the song Safety's Off that we led with in the beginning of this broadcast and we're closing out with. If you like the tunes, check out Alas on SoundCloud. Amazing, powerful voice. And Bon is going to close us out.
I think final thoughts are that really excited to connect with people who have different perspectives and ones that really decenter whiteness and really center like our own well-being and connection with the land. And so with that, you can find this broadcast on any of the usual podcast platforms or at www.indigenousaction.org. And you can also email us pictures of burning cop cars, any questions or topics you'd like to hear us go claws out on at iainfo@protonmail.com.